I bring to the table local knowledge of how things can actually work on the ground here in Alaska.
The EPA administrator overseeing Alaska has long tenure in the 49th state. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the legislature can't agree on a funding source for education.
We're just very disappointed that in a discussion about early funding, that 3 weeks were completely wasted in the House.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Southeast Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss possible federal subsistence fish and shellfish proposals and other subsistence-related issues and invites public participation at a meeting February 13th through the 15th, starting at 8:30 a.m. at the Vocational Training and Resource Center in Juneau. More at doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
The Republican members of the state Senate said today they want Governor Bill Walker to ask Senate District E Republicans for more suggestions on who should replace Mike Dunleavy if he won't pick one of the existing three nominees. They said in a letter to Walker that it would be unfair to either confirm or reject Walker's appointment of Randall Kowalke to replace Dunleavy. Walker appointed Kowalke on Friday instead of one of the district party nominees. Those are Representative George Rauscher, teacher Todd Smolden, and organic food worker Tom Brond. Traditionally, governors have filled vacancies with one of three nominees of the district party. But Walker also didn't pick one of House District 40 Democrats' original nominees after Dean Westlake resigned. If the Senate Republicans don't act on Kowalke, the position will remain vacant. State law gives the governor 30 days to appoint someone to fill a vacancy. The person must be from the same political party as the previous office holder, and the sitting members of the chamber from the same party must approve them. State law doesn't limit the amount of time Senate Republicans have to confirm Walker's appointee. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has a big part to play in some very controversial issues in Alaska and beyond, from the proposed Pebble Mine to national climate policy. The Trump administration recently appointed Alaskan Chris Laddick to lead EPA Region 10. He'll oversee EPA's work in Alaska, as well as in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk got a chance to catch up with Laddick at a conference in Anchorage yesterday. In a wide-ranging conversation, Laddick weighed in on the recent Pebble Mine decision, EPA's budget, and climate change.
Before landing his federal post, Chris Laddick spent a lot of time at various levels of government in Alaska. Most recently, Laddick was a member of Governor Bill Walker's cabinet, serving as Commerce Commissioner. Before that, he worked for the cities of Unalaska, Dillingham, and Galena. Laddick thinks that experience will come in handy.
I bring to the table local knowledge of how things can actually work on the ground here in Alaska.
Laddick says his boss, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, recently called him up for some of that local knowledge on a hot topic for many Alaskans, the proposed Pebble Mine.
He was interested in knowing how many people the commercial fishing out there employs as opposed to what the mine will employ. And I think he went through a process in his mind of weighing all the issues together.
Shortly after that conversation, Pruitt made big news. He decided to keep in play EPA's proposal to put environmental restrictions on the mine, a move that surprised and thrilled Pebble's opponents. But Laddick declined to speculate on Pruitt's decision.
Why do you think he came to this decision at this particular time?
I think you'd have to ask him that.
Laddick says despite Pruitt's decision, EPA is keeping busy with Pebble. The company still aims to get its permits, and EPA is working with the Army Corps of Engineers as it prepares an environmental impact statement for the mine. That's just one of many big projects EPA is involved with in Alaska. Others include the Donlin Mine and the Nanushuk Project, a big North Slope oil development. Meanwhile, the Trump administration just proposed steep budget cuts for EPA as a whole, reducing its funding by more than a quarter and eliminating thousands of jobs at the agency. Laddick didn't criticize the cuts, saying part of his job is to figure out how to do more with less.
Our workload is expanding while our budgets are decreasing, so we have to make sure that we focus on the right things.
Laddick noted that last year, Congress didn't go through with all the cuts the Trump administration asked for. He expects the same thing to happen again this year. But Laddick did acknowledge that if Congress went through with the budget as it's proposed, it would impact EPA's work in the region.
If there's a 30% cut, I think everybody will feel it. That's a lot of money.
In the document outlining its proposed budget, EPA touts the cuts, saying it's proud to be a good steward of taxpayer resources and to efficiently deliver environmental protection. Environmental groups, on the other hand, criticized the budget proposal, saying it would endanger the environment and public health. Environmental groups are also slamming Trump's EPA for its approach to climate change. Pruitt questions the extent to which human activity is causing climate change. And under him, EPA is walking back Obama-era proposals to regulate greenhouse gases. Being from Alaska, Laddick says he can't deny climate change is an issue.
I've been involved in Arctic issues since, at least 16 years ago, and there's no doubt the Arctic is changing.
EPA may be stepping away from its Obama-era focus on regulating greenhouse gases, but Laddick says he wants the agency to continue working with communities affected by warming. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
President Trump delivered his 2019 budget request to Capitol Hill this week, and it would cut a lot of line items that benefit Alaska. The budget is more of a statement of values than a spending plan, since Congress ultimately decides. But Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin trolled through the documents for cuts with special Alaska significance. She sent this audio listicle.
Here are five programs the administration wants to cut that would pinch Alaska. The budget proposes to eliminate the Denali Commission. That's an independent agency that awards federal grants for infrastructure projects in rural Alaska. President Trump would reduce the funding from $17 million to $7 million, just enough to allow for an orderly shutdown. The administration says the commission is hard to justify in a state that can afford to dole out dividends to each of its citizens. The budget would also cut two other regional commissions in the lower 48. Trump wants to trim Native American housing grants. The changes would mean a loss of about $15 million for Alaska construction projects. The White House would cut a USDA grant program that has sent millions to Alaska each year to fund water and wastewater projects in rural Alaska, where some 3,000 homes lack running water and flush toilets. The budget would reform Essential Air Service to save $57 million. It's not clear whether Alaska's share of the pot would grow or shrink under this reform. Essential Air Service now pays air carriers $22 million to subsidize passenger service to 61 Alaska communities. The administration wants to eliminate funding for LIHEAP, that's the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, and also end weatherization assistance. Together, the two sent nearly $19 million to Alaska last year. If these proposed cuts alarm you, Senator Lisa Murkowski suggests you remain calm, because the president's budget is just one step in a long process. The Trump administration tried to make cuts like these last year, but instead of eliminating the Denali Commission, for instance, Congress decided to increase its funding by some 13%. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The fate of an education funding bill is now up to the state Senate. The House passed it last week. House Bill 287 provides early funding for student transportation across the state and Mount Edgecombe High School. But the bill, as it's currently written, no longer accomplishes its original primary purpose. More than $1 billion to fund per student funding for all Alaska schools was stripped out. That happened because the House failed to fund the bill. Mount Edgecombe and transportation were funded through a separate source of money. Fairbanks Republican Senate President Pete Kelly says he thinks House leaders were knowingly misleading in saying that the bill would fund all schools early.
I don't want you to think that the Senate doesn't have a desire to early fund education, because we do. We're just very disappointed that in a discussion about early funding, that 3 weeks were completely wasted in the House.
The House bill would have funded schools by drawing from the constitutional budget reserve, but three quarters of each chamber must approve drawing money from the CBR, and only 20 of the 36 House members who were present voted for the draw. Homer Republican Representative Paul Seaton is the House Finance Committee co-chair. Seaton says the Senate could vote for a CBR draw or fund the school money by drawing from permanent fund earnings.
It just depends on the priority of your funding source. And so the options are all on the table for the Senate to put whichever funding source that they think is best in that.
The bill has been referred to the Senate Finance Committee, which hasn't announced a hearing on it. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, state Democrats reflect on candidate vetting after two controversial resignations.
I think there is a concerted effort to change a culture here in Juneau, and I hope across the state and across the country as well.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV.
In the summer of 2016, Alaska State Democratic leaders supported the primary campaigns of Dean Westlake and Zach Fansler. 18 months later, both have resigned. Westlake over sexual harassment allegations, Fansler after a woman alleged he assaulted her. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman talked with Democratic legislators and one of the women who raised concerns over harassment about what should happen next.
In July 2016, many of the leading Democrats in Alaska gathered in an Anchorage house for a fundraiser to benefit two primary challengers. They were Dean Westlake in District 40, which covers North Slope and Northwest Arctic boroughs, and Zach Fansler in District 38, which includes the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Anchorage Representative Ivy Sponholz was among those at the party. This is what she had to say then about Benjamin Nagiak and Bob Herron, who then represented the districts.
What we've had are, you know, two representatives in these communities that are Democrats in name only.
Westlake and Fansler won the primaries and joined the House last year. But Westlake resigned in December after women inside and outside of the Capitol accused him of sexual harassment. Fansler resigned earlier this month after a woman accused him of repeatedly slapping her, bursting one of her eardrums. His lawyer says Fansler denies the allegations. Sponholz says the party will more closely scrutinize candidates' past conduct in the future.
I think that what we know now is that in 2018, we have a higher standard for behavior than any of our processes have reflected in the past. In the past, the legislature and political parties have been more likely to hide these problems and to sweep them under the rug.
In the case of Westlake, some of those who came forward said the harassment occurred before he ran for the legislature, and news organizations reported in December that he had fathered a child when he was 28 with a girl who was 15 when the child was conceived. Olivia Garrett is a former legislative aide who says Westlake harassed her after he joined the legislature.
They didn't really do their homework on this guy. And it wasn't like there was just rumors about past misconduct with him. You know, there was a whole mountain of evidence of, you know, some pretty terrible things he's done to much younger women. And that's pretty unacceptable that nobody stopped to say, hey, maybe we should reevaluate who we're giving all of our time and resources to.
There's no earlier public record of harassment involving Fansler, but community members had expressed concern about his alcohol use before he was elected, and Kuskokwim 300 race chairman Myron Angstman says that while Fansler did a decent job when he was the race's manager, Angstman also was concerned that Fansler's drinking may have affected how he did his job on multiple occasions. Garrett says this is an opportunity for the Democrats to more closely scrutinize candidates. She says one step that could reduce sexual misconduct is increasing the number of women in the legislature.
I think women in leadership will not solve it entirely, but will make the workplace a lot better for a lot of other women.
Sponholz also says having more women would be beneficial. The District 38 Democrats have started taking applicants, and Sponholz says it would be positive if a woman stepped forward.
There's been a great deal of management and leadership research that shows that having more women involved in leadership results in more productive organizations, more effective organizations, and certainly more professional organizations. So I would welcome an Alaska Native woman to come in from rural Alaska to take the seat.
House Speaker Bryce Edgman says he expects that both political parties will examine candidates' pasts more closely, including questions about sexual misconduct.
I think that should be part of the vetting process. There's no question about that. And, you know, returning back to the theme of lessons learned, I would have to say that the political parties, the major parties in Alaska, certainly have been watching this very closely. And like those of us in the legislature, don't want to have to undergo this again in the future.
Edgman says the legislature already has taken steps to become a safer place. They include making it mandatory for lawmakers and staff to attend training to prevent sexual and other workplace harassment.
I think there is a concerted effort to change a culture here in Juneau, and I hope across the state and across the country as well. And I view this as a watershed moment, and I think we in the Alaska legislature are doing our best to be part of that.
In addition, the legislature's harassment policy subcommittee has been meeting to discuss changes to the policy. With help from Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage and Teresa Katsarilos in Bethel, in Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Alan Moore has mushed himself into the elite class of Yukon Quest champions. Moore joins John Schandelmeyer, Hans Gott, and Lance Mackey, who have all won the quest three or more times. KUAC's Zoe Rome was at the finish this morning in Whitehorse to see Moore arrive and claim his third title.
Snow was falling on the finish line at Whitehorse as crowds waited for a headlight to bob into view. Then, suddenly, a team of dogs led by Alan Moore emerged from the distance to loud cheers.
Excellent. Welcome to Whitehorse, Mr. Moore.
This is Alan Moore's seventh Yukon quest and third victory. His consistent lead earned him the poke of gold in Dawson and the rare accomplishment of crossing the finish line with all 14 dogs.
You know, not many people have arrived at the finish chute in any position with 14 dogs. And if I knew the answer, how to do that every time, I would be doing it.
Conditions were good this year, and aside from the cold, one of the better years on the trail.
This one comparatively was not as tough because the trail was great. The only thing you had to deal with was the cold.
Moore arrived in Whitehorse this morning after slower progress through fluffy white snow that covered the trail and obscured Moore's vision.
Well, I wish I could have seen, but when it's snowing like this, in my headlight, I could only see just a small place. I couldn't see anything other than the dogs.
Despite less than ideal conditions on the home stretch, Moore arrived with a comfy lead of several hours over Matt Hall, the second musher expected to cross the finish line. Now it's on to the next thing. Moore's dogs will compete in the Iditarod in just a few short weeks with his wife, Allie Zirkel. Moore will be taking out a team of youngsters and hopefully getting them in shape for next year's Yukon Quest. On the Yukon Quest Trail in Whitehorse, I'm Zoe Rome.
Last year's Quest winner Matt Hall did cross the finish line in second place this afternoon, followed by fellow veteran Laura Neese in third.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger.
common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Support for Public Radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station.
Logan Hahnemann did not advance out of qualification in the men's classic sprint at the Olympics in South Korea. The 24-year-old, who grew up skiing in Fairbanks, placed 42nd in the sprint qualifier earlier today, outside the top 30 that move on to heats that determine a winner. Alaska Pacific University program teammate Eric Bjornsson squeaked in the 30th spot, but did not make it to the final, which was won by Norwegian Johannes Klebo. On the women's side, Bjornsson's sister, APU skier Sadie Bjornsson, easily qualified for the heats, but also did not reach the final, which was won by Sweden's Stina Nielsen. The Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea, feature a key ingredient, winter weather. That's a departure from the last Olympic Games in Sochi, Russia, where high temperatures strayed into the upper 50s. Brian Bretschneider with our Ask a Climatologist segment says Pyeongchang is at about the same latitude as Washington, D.C., but he told Alaska's Energy Desk editor Annie Feit that their climate in February is very similar to Anchorage.
So their normal high is about 30, their normal low is about 12 or 13, which is exactly the same or within a degree or two of what Anchorage is this time of year. So it should have the look and feel of Anchorage. And they're on the eastern part of the Asian continent, and they are in the winter months subject to the forces of the dominant Siberian high-pressure system. So that's an area that gets very, very cold in the winter. They normally have winds that come out of the north, so they're going to get this cold, dry flow coming in from Siberia, and it's going to functionally make them feel like they're much farther north than they actually are.
And we've heard some talk with the Olympic coverage that for its latitude, it's the coldest spot in the world. Is that true?
It basically is true. There's a couple of spots in central China and then some areas at high elevation. So there's actually some areas that, like in Colorado, that are at about the same latitude or even farther south, but at like 11,000 feet that are going to be colder. And a few areas in, say, Kazakhstan and then western mainland China. But again, those are going to be at higher elevations. I believe there's one city in China that with a million population that's a little bit farther south, that's a little bit colder. But again, that's nitpicking. It's really for its latitude. It's about as cold as you can get anywhere on Earth.
And how does the cold at this Olympics in Pyeongchang stack up to previous Winter Olympics?
Well, as I said, normally it should be about 22 degrees if you average the high and the low. This year, it's looking like it's going to be closer to around 30, so an above normal temperature. That's still going to put it as the coldest Winter Olympics since Lillehammer in 1994. The Sochi Olympics were famously warm, highs near 60 and lows near 40. Before that, Vancouver was quite warm. Even Salt Lake City was fairly warm. So, yeah, so you got to go back, over 20 years to find a colder Olympics. Now, before Lillehammer in 94, there was some cold Olympics, say, in Lake Placid, in Sapporo, Squaw Valley, some other places, Oslo, Norway, that were colder than what we're going to experience here in 2018. But it's going to have the look and feel much more like a winter Olympics than the last few, for sure.
Brian Bretschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage. He checks in with Alaska's Energy Desk each week as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. An international e-commerce retailer is again featuring items that a Juneau resident crafted from sea otter fur. This after the Alaska Native artist petitioned Etsy to relist the items, and U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan exchanged letters with the company. KTOO's Trip Krause looks into Etsy's policy and how it conflicts with a federal exemption to allow Alaska Natives to sell certain crafts.
Etsy says it's moving away from local and national laws, such as the U.S. Endangered Species Act, and toward international standards. Those standards don't include an exemption for Alaska Native artists. So the company says it removed ivory items from its website. Items made from endangered species, such as some populations of sea otters, were also removed. Marcus Goh is Inupiaq Eskimo. He hunts sea otters in southeast Alaska and uses the pelts to create scarves, gloves, vests, and other items. He heard of Etsy delisting other artists' items and reached out to his customer service representative out of concern. That's when the representative noticed his sea otter items.
After a while, she told me that because sea otters were endangered, my items would be delisted. And then, you know, this confused and it got me a little bit frustrated because they're not. We have so many sea otters here.
The two began exchanging links. Goh says the confusion on Etsy's part comes from geography and the distinct populations across Alaska.
I do have sold some things on Etsy. It's not the biggest source of the revenue that I have for my sea otter for business. Most of the stuff that I sell go to other stores for resale.
Goh says he uses Etsy to reach customers that he otherwise couldn't. He petitioned Etsy saying that the population of southeast sea otters aren't endangered. And eventually his items were relisted. That was good news for U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan's office and spokesman Matt Shekaro.
I think it's important to recognize that there has been some movement or conversations between Etsy and some Alaska Native artists. The senator and also the office are hopeful that we can find a positive solution for those that may not have been able to relist their items, and we can find some resolution for those artisans.
Earlier this month, the Alaska Republican had sent a letter to Etsy following reports of walrus ivory and sea otter items being delisted from the online retailer. Etsy did not respond to a request for comment. In Juneau, I'm Trip J. Krause.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Trip Krause in Juneau. Elizabeth Harbaugh and Annie Fight in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zoe Rome in Whitehorse, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The North Slope Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss possible federal subsistence fish and shellfish proposals and other subsistence-related issues and invites public participation at a meeting February 14th and 15th starting at 9 a.m. at the North Slope Borough Assembly Chambers in Utqiagvik. More at 800-478-1456. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Family Education Loan so parents, a spouse, or grandparents can help students with the cost of college or training programs in or outside of Alaska. Interest rates are lower than the Federal Plus, and no credit is required. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
If you love a good mystery, Thursday nights on Alaska Public Media TV is the place for you. Join us every week as we search for clues, put the pieces together, and figure out who done it. Mystery Thursdays only on Alaska Public Media TV. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.